This is an interview with Jim Pearson, recorded by Di Booker on the 18th of January at Campbelltown. It is part of the Campbelltown City Council Oral History Project, Our Fruitful Record, A History of Market Gardens in Campbelltown. So thank you very much, Jim, for agreeing to be part of this project. And I look forward to hearing your story, and we'll talk about your involvement with the Market Gardens and also your families.
Okay.
So can we start by talking about the family?
Well, I guess my forefathers immigrated from Cambridgeshire, England, and my great-great-grandfather was James Pearson, who migrated from Cambridgeshire and set up property at Reedbeds in South Australia.
Whereabouts is Reedbeds?
It's down Henley Beach Way.
Oh, okay.
And my great-grandfather was Smith Pearson, who lived in James Street, Campbelltown. And he was a councillor, I believe, in 1888.
So one of the early councils.
And a JP, I think, in 1880. Mm. And he and his wife had 12 children, one of which died, one of which was James Benjamin Pearson, was my grandfather. And he established a property on Glynde Road. Now, the family had an inheritance from England, which enabled them all to buy a property and set up. And that's where the history more or less started from. So my father was born on Glynde Road, Alfred James Smith.
And when was he born?
1907. Mm. And my grandfather had a market garden on Glynde Road. My father, as a young man, went up to the Adelaide Hills, Kerry's Gully, cleared land and established a property up there. So, which he grew all sorts of crops, fruit crops, vegetables, everything. One of the main problems up there was a very shortage of water. They spent a lot of money digging wells to try and find additional water. My grandfather died, and my father ran his property in the Adelaide Hills at Kerry's Gully, and also ran his mother's property, who it belonged to then, on Glynde Road. He did that for a number of years, and it got too much, so he sold the property up in Kerry's Gully and worked for his mother. Well, those days, when the parents died, the siblings never knew who was going to get what. It wasn't talked about. My father was left the property on Glynde Road, from which he then expanded. He bought the property next door. We had a property across the road where the opposite the Lutheran Church, and he also had, they had 5 acres up the corner of Reed Avenue and Glynde Road.
How many acres altogether?
Had 8 acres on Glynde Road, 5 acres up corner of Reed Avenue and Glynde Road, and 3.5 acres the corner of Lewis Road and Glynde Road. So that's where he was operating from when I was born, as a young person. So from there, we went on, and gradually urban development came along. And he thought he'd expand. He bought a property in James Street, Campbelltown. Hence, my great-grandfather lived in James Street. So he bought a property off Wilton Brothers down the end of James Street, and which was 14 acres of market garden. He had another, I think it was 2 or 3 acres across the road on the river where the sheds, everything was situated. But he'd already sold off then the property on Reed Avenue and the property on Lewis Road. So he had 8 acres on Glynde Road and the 14 acres down at James Street. we operated there.
Is that where the golf course is?
That's where the golf course is. The club rooms was, that was our home. It was built in the late 50s.
Right.
I sort of spent my early childhood on Glen Road, then my youth in James Street. So that's where we're from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was educated at Abray Agricultural High School. I went there for 3 years.
Let's just go back a step. So when were you born, Jim?
1943.
Mm-hmm. And before you went to Abray, did you go to local primary
school? I went to St. Morris Primary School.
Right.
Myself and my sisters went to St. Morris Primary School. We rode our bikes there. For some reason, our parents didn't want us to go to Paynham Primary School. For whatever reason, I do not know, but never mind, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So that was the background of my beginnings. Well, then the situation arose where the proposed Oban busway was going to be built, and that was going to traverse diagonally through our property at James Street, Campbelltown, and which meant it would be inoperable.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was approached by the government buyer who wanted to acquire the property. In the meantime, knowing what was going to happen, we'd bought a property in Virginia, 41.5 acres. And I might add, when I left school, my father did not want me to come into the business. We had long arguments about it, and I was determined, and he was determined. But eventually, for better or worse, I won out.
Often it's the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah,
the father wants the son to come and the son.
But you know, he'd been through the Depression, the Second World War. He'd been through extremely hard and difficult times. And he made a good living and worked very hard and was very successful. But anyhow, long and short of it, we bought the property at Virginia and began to develop that.
Mm.
In the meantime, the government had acquired our property at James Street, with the exception of the home and the sheds.
Right. So what year was that?
That would have been in the 1960s, I can't tell you exactly what year it was. I would say it would have been in the early 1960s. So that meant the demise of that property. We did rent it back off the government for a number of years, but we found that it was just inoperable to run three properties at Glen Road, James Street and Virginia. So Dad eventually sold the Glen Road place. Prior to selling it, sometime prior to that, the drive-in, Hectorville drive-in was built, and they took a piece of Dad's land, and they had that for many years, which they paid him rent for. But he eventually sold the whole property to the people who had the drive-in theatre. So that meant we had two properties, James Street and Virginia. We gradually developed Virginia, and we gradually moved everything out there, and we bought more lands subsequent to that. We'd bought another further 20 acres and another further 20 acres. So we had 80 acres out there where we grew potatoes initially, and then we went on to grow potatoes and celery. Then we proceeded, because we had the spare land, plants 20 acres of almond trees. And then further to that, we bought with my two cousins, bought another 20 acres out there, which we had another 20 acres of almonds. And by this time, our young trees we harvested the first crop by hand, and it was just the advent of mechanical harvesting for almonds. There were three other growers and myself, we all combined to buy pieces of equipment in order to mechanically harvest the almonds. We subcontracted to each other, which meant the hand harvesting was no longer taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So we we gradually expanded so that when my father passed away, and I think it was 75. I stopped growing potatoes then to reassess my operation, and then went on just to grow celery and almonds. A year later, my two cousins, Des and Jeff Kimber, joined me in the partnership. We went on to expand the celery production, and we planted more almonds until they decided to retire in 1998. Jeff decided to retire, and I decided to dissolve the partnership at that point in time. So,
because the Kimbers also market gardened in.
Oh yes, Canada. They were originally in Athelstan, and they lost their property when their grandmother passed away, and it was left to their uncle who then wanted to dispose of the property, so they virtually had nowhere else to go. And I offered them an opportunity, which they accepted. And we went on for 22 years together at Virginia.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So getting back to Campbelltown and this area, so what were the crops that you were growing here?
Well, Dad originally grew... As a child, he grew mainly cauliflowers, was all the winter crop. Then he grew carrots. He grew some lettuce at times, grew some pumpkins over the summer. But the principal crop was cauliflowers. As a small child, that was. And then when he bought the property at James Street from Wilton Brothers, he started to grow celery. They were growing celery, so he expanded into celery production both there and on the Glen Road. But originally, he grew cauliflowers. And again, when he bought the property at James Street, we started to grow potatoes as well. And we grew sweet corn. So a mixture of things.
Yeah. So what was the soil like?
Well, James Street was river loam. I would say there'd be 60% of the soil was beautiful, rich loam. And the other was river silt, which wasn't very good soil. It grew certain things quite well, but it wasn't good. The heavy river loam was really good, but the silty soil wasn't so good. It was easy to work and everything like that, but it just wasn't as good a soil. We carted all sorts of animal manure on it and all sorts to try and build it up. But wasn't too bad, really. The Glen Road was red-brown earth, which is heavy clay soil, very difficult to work.
Especially when it's wet.
Yes, absolutely, but it grew good produce. The problem on the Glen Road was the water supply wasn't good. The water was very poor quality, but it didn't seem to affect the crops we grew because of the heavy soil. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of water there.
So did you drop bores or...?
We had one bore on the Glen Road. The property up at Reed Avenue had a pipeline from the Glen Road through the neighbours' properties to that property. In those days, everything was trench irrigated. Down at James Street, we went to sprinkler irrigation as well as flood irrigation.
So were you able to take water out of the river?
No, we didn't. We were one property back from the river. We had one bore down there, and we had a very good well. The well never let us down. Summer, winter, drought, flood, we could extract 5,000 gallons an hour out of that well. So that was the mainstay of the irrigation down there.
How often did you water? You know, was it once a day, once a week?
Well, depending on the time of the year, when you grew celery, when you first transplanted out, you water every day, and then every couple of days, and just depending on the weather. That was always a horrible job of mine, trench irrigating, because you had the water, you had to run it down the trenches, not to get it to the end of the rows, and not to waste it, and you'd be standing there in the heat, and watering it. It was tried to water everything up Saturday so you didn't have to do too much on Sundays.
Yeah.
But, you know, it took a lot of time.
Yes. So I guess the difference now with the property out at Virginia, you must have huge differences in the way you water and...
Everything's totally different. Now we've got 100 acres of almonds. They've got all permanent under-tree sprinklers. And the sprinklers are run by a computer. The pumps start up of a night time.
Now, somebody told me that you can turn them on and off from here.
That's correct.
Right.
I can run it from the computer at home, and we can see how much water the pumps are pumping, and they've got safety systems built in. If they're over the flow rate or under the flow rate by 14%, they'll shut down the system. We have soil moisture monitors. We can monitor the soil, the depth of the moisture in the soil, and the salinity in the soil, and we irrigate of a night time. We irrigate every 3 days, and so we're able to.
So you can really admire people like your grandparents and yourself in the early days to be able to judge just what was needed by looking at the soil and how the crops were going, rather than relying on technology.
Well, that's true, but it's like second nature to you. You just knew what to do. Now, to try and explain to somebody, it's very difficult because you grew up with it, everything, you grew with it, and you do things without even thinking because it's your second nature to do what you got to do. And of course, those days there were no herbicides, we had to hand hoe the celery, cultivate the cauliflowers, and hoe the weeds, and insecticides were dusted on, or celery in the celery's case we sprayed on. A little crawler tractor with a tank and a boom, we sprayed that. With the fungicides were the main problem there. But it was a much simpler life, but it was a lot of hard work.
Yes, and especially in hot weather.
Yes.
And in winter, when it's raining.
Yeah, well, yeah, it didn't make any difference whether it was pouring rain or not. You went out and you had to cut your load for market.
Right.
Had to be done no matter what the weather.
So did you employ other people to work in the gardens?
Yes, when I left school, Dad had three men full-time and we had casual labour as well. We employed some Italian ladies to help. And on the weekends, we always had three or four Italian immigrants. These are young guys that immigrated from Italy and it was their second job. Bearing in mind a lot of those young people coming out from Italy had to borrow money to get their fare to get to Australia. So their second job helped them establish themselves. And of course, coming from Italy after the Second World War, money meant nothing to them, currency. That's why as soon as they got enough money, they always bought property. Because property was always there. These guys were very good. They worked well. We'd have three or four every Saturday and sometimes Sunday mornings to finish off what we had to do. And I used to have to work with them. And I was sort of the pacemaker when we come to hoeing celery and that sort of thing. I'd stagger back home Saturday night absolutely exhausted. But, you know, it was good, you know. And... yeah, you'd never want to see your son work like a lot of us guys had to work those days.
No. So did it leave you any time for a social life?
Oh, eventually. So, work was always first.
Yes.
You know, if you had any time for social life, that always had to come second.
So what was happening in the community? What did you do?
I never participated in sport. Because at that time when I was young, we were starting in Virginia, so my spare time was out there on the weekends. So I never participated in sport. In fact, once we started out there, I was an absolute stranger in my district for 20 years. Because I'd get in the car and go to work out there and come home. It was family and work. There was nothing in between. So, you know, it was a different time.
But so for your father and your grandfather, what sort of things were happening in the community mean, how did you meet girls?
I used to go to the local Norwood dance and different other things around the place of a night time. There was the days of the Findon and the Fiesta Villa and different other venues. Used to go out of a night time. Norwood dance was always very good of a Thursday night. Well, I could only go there for summertime because during the winter I'd be going to market. Yeah. You know, there Saturday nights. And so, you know, you sort of went out on weeknights, not weeknights so much as weekends.
And but what sort of community involvement then did your parents have? Where did they meet?
Well, I'm not quite sure, really. No. I think probably my father met my mother through his sisters. That I'm not quite sure. Yeah, yeah. Dad was very involved with horses, harness horses. He, over his lifetime, had a lot of very, very good horses, very successful horses.
Where did he keep those?
Well, he usually had trainers that kept them.
Right.
In my earliest days, he always had a horse at home, but then not with his business and that. He never had time to do much with them, so he had trainers train them. So that was his big thing. In the latter part of life, he was a member of all the trotting clubs, the racing clubs. That was his life. He loved his horses.
Most people who are involved with horses do, don't they?
Yeah, they're very passionate about it.
Yeah, there's something about that relationship between man and horse.
As a small child, Dad always had horses at home. We had the draft horse, Clydesdale, for the work in the market garden. Dad bought a little Ransom Crawler tractor. That came in the gate one day and the horse went out the gate at the end of the week because that replaced the horse.
So what year was that, or roundabout?
In the early 1950s, about 1952 or 3, I think. But it would have been about then because I think I was driving it when I was 8 years old. I used to sit on it and drive it and harrow the ground and roll the ground in preparation for it to be drilled out in trenches to plant the celery, etc.
So it was just a small tractor because the...
He had a bigger tractor that did the ploughing, all the heavy work, but this is a small tractor that did all the cultivated between the...
Manoeuvred well.
Which I've got photos of.
Right.
So that we had a number of those over the years, but that eliminated the horse.
Yeah. So when you were planting, and did you have some mechanism for planting out?
Yes, it was called a trowel and a finger and bend your back. Because when Dad was growing cauliflowers, they always saved their seed. They had their different varieties. All the growers had their different varieties that come in different times of the year. They used to save the seed and select the particular selection and save the seed, and they grew the seedlings in seed beds. Then transplanted them out. We used to run the water down trenches with the cauliflowers. They used to use a trowel just to pull the wet soil apart, drop the plant in. It was all flood irrigation. Then with celery, we used to run it water down the trenches. We again used to grow our own seedlings. You'd select them out of the seed bed, leave the weaker plants and think the best plants, and you transplant them. You'd cut the tips of the taproot root off and cut the tops off, then you'd finger plant them in the mud. So it's been head down and backside up, and you know, you'd start planting celery in December, late December, and you plant right through until early April. You'd plant every week, so you'd have a continuity of supply coming when you start to harvest every week. So it was very, very important to get your planting done. So you had that continuity of supply.
So were there spreadsheets around the kitchen table where you organised the year to work out when things were happening, or was it just intuition?
It was all in the head. It was all intuition. The only books they had was a book to know when to plant the seed beds, They always had a date when they planted the seed beds of different varieties. And that was always kept in the seed box, which was a steel trunk where they used to keep all the seed in Hessian bags. So, you know, I went through the stage in my early days. We used to save, select our particular heads of celery and save them for seed and collect the seed. In latter times, you used to bought commercial seed, hybrid seed, etc. But again, back in the early days, growers had their own varieties and they would jealously guard those varieties.
Yes.
And that was there.
I'm amazed at the amount of how Campbelltown became known as the celery centre, and you know just how much celery, for example, was grown.
Well, in my early days, they used to send train loads of celery to Melbourne.
Really?
Then later, it used to go to Sydney. They used to send it in ice cars. They were the celery would go down to the coal stores and be pre-cooled. We stacked in cars, which were rail cars that were stacked up with ice in the ends to keep it cool. That was the early days when it used to go to Sydney. But Melbourne, we used to go down to Melbourne. I used to go at least twice a week to Melbourne. It used to send it up to a train load to Melbourne. But what happened, it was eventually the growers in Melbourne got hold of some of the varieties and gradually started to grow it and started to persevere with it. And the climatic difference over there enabled them eventually to grow all year round. They tolerated a lot of losses in the early summer, late spring when it used to bolt, go to seed. They tolerated that and they persevered and persevered and eventually developed varieties where they could grow all year round. So there's practically no celery growing here in South Australia now, a very small amount. The biggest growers in Australia are in Melbourne.
But using the ancestors of this, the seeds came from here.
Well, to start with, but nowadays they save some of their own, but there's a lot of imported seed hybrid varieties and that that are growing now. But they've got a huge market in Victoria in itself and Sydney and Canberra, which is not too distant.
No.
These days, the cost of freighting is a very, very big drawback. And plus the fact it's because our climatic conditions, it's difficult to grow all year round here in the state.
So where did you sell the crops, Jim? Did you go into the East End market?
Yes. I was sent in there when I was 18. My father said to me, "I've been doing it for 30 years. You're doing it. It's not a matter, will you do it, you're doing it. And you will do this and that and everything else." I had strict guidelines. And my instructions were never to cut the price, because those days, believe it or not, different commodity groups had price-fixing committees. And they had a committee, and Fruit Growers and Market Gardeners Association had these various price-fixing committees, and the growers would get together and organise what prices they'd charge for the produce. And that's what they stuck by. And you knew if someone cut the price, the word would get around quickly. And it worked very well. But it started to break down as more and more of the ethnic growers came into the market. They tended to be panic sellers. They had to shift their load no matter what. And it tended to break it down. Of course, now it's illegal to have such a thing. But all the growers had their customers, because those days, when I first went to market, there was a lot of hawkers, they used to call them. They were retailers that go door to door. There's a lot of shopkeepers, and all the country towns had fruit shops, fruit and veg shops. And this is before the Woolworths and the Coles and the supermarkets came in. And some of those country towns had very, very big operations in the fruit and veg shops there, and they were very good customers to have too, because they'd in most cases only buy the quality produce, and it worked very well. But with the advent of the supermarkets, it was started to begin the demise of the growers, as I see it, because they the pressure's back on the growers.
And to cut the prices as well, probably.
Well, yeah, well, they always pressurise because they're big buyers and want to buy better, et cetera, et cetera. The case is such now that I believe the supermarkets only really want to deal with the big operators. The smaller growers, the rats and mice, so to speak, they don't want to be bothered with. They either deal with merchants or agents that handle big quantities of produce that supply all year round, or bigger growers that supply all year round. And so this is where it's at, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Times move on, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have any specific contracts with manufacturers? Or
no, no, never.
No, so you just sold through the markets?
Yes, yeah. And we always tried to sell with many customers, whether they're very small, big, or everywhere in between. Mm. It was always better to have a full book of customers, because if you lose one or two, you haven't lost much. But if you're dealing with two or three big ones, you lose one.
Yeah.
It's a big hit.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you've got photos, but I've seen photos of trucks of cauliflowers.
I've got them.
Thousands of cauliflowers.
Yeah.
I don't know. How did they stay on the back of the truck?
Not a problem. I could stack a load.
And how long would it take to stack a load?
Oh, well, those days, cauliflowers grew, and of course, used to go through and cut what was called the fit cauliflowers, the ones that were ready. They weren't all ready at the same time. Mm. Today, they tend to more, the hybrid varieties tend to come ready all at once, but those days, you'd have to cut through maybe two or three or four times, and you'd carry them out to the end where you had a track where you could stack them up, get in there with a truck to load them up.
Mm.
That's how it was done.
Mm.
You know, it wouldn't matter if it was pouring with rain, you bogged up to your knees, you still had to cut the load and get them out and get them loaded up.
The market didn't stop, did it?
The market didn't stop.
Mm. Mm. And so I guess it seems as though, from what you're saying, that the market itself was a fairly close community of growers.
It was. It was. Because the growers that used to attend the market, I'm going back to as a child, it was like a meeting place of growers as well as your customers and everything. And in the days of the market when I went there, it was very controlled. All the growers had their stands within the market. We had a stand in the market, which we paid rent for. And you had to be in the market by a certain time, and this, you weren't allowed to touch your load until 7 o'clock the siren went.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, you'd be in there and you'd see all your customers. They'd do their ordering and buying. Some would pay for it as they ordered, others would pay for it when they collected it, or you delivered it to their trucks or had it delivered to their trucks. Some would run an account, so it was a whole mixture of things happening. And at 7 o'clock when the siren went, it's all hell broke loose. You know, the trucks would all come down out the lofts, the hand trucks, greengrocers and truckies, we call them. You'd pay somebody to deliver your produce to the various retailers or wherever.
Mm.
All hell would break loose, and it'd be absolutely bedlam for a couple of hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah. So what happened when the market closed? Where did you go after that?
Well, I'd finished going to market prior to it closing, so I'd stopped going.
Right.
At the time, we were growing celery and going to market. I spent years semi-conscious, just so dog-tired. And we had the opportunity, a large grower of celery, they'd stopped growing, and we had the opportunity to fill that gap and exporting to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I stopped growing then, and we started to send it, all our produce to Sydney. We still had one or two local customers, but they used to come to the farm and pick it up. But that was a big relief for me. But the other thing I found, that I'd spent about 20 hours a week in marketing, delivering, running into the market back, and I said to my father at the time, look, I have more time, we'll be able to grow more. And he said, look, he said, make sure whatever you grow, you manage it. Don't try and grow too much. And the difference being home working with the men was just unbelievably better, the productivity was better. Mm. Not that the men were bludging, don't get me wrong, they worked well. Mm. But it's just that you're with them and you start to have time to think because you weren't so dog tired, and you think and plan and get a strategy on what you were doing. But then we exported to Sydney for a number of years. And then in the latter part, we had merchants here that were supplying, one supplying Coles and one supplying Woolworths. They sought produce from us. We supplied them and also supplied Sydney. So we had those three arms operating. But that worked very well, trying to balance it all out so we never let anyone down. It was sometimes a bit difficult when things got a bit short.
Your children, are they involved with...
My son is. Yeah. My son left school and he didn't want to do anything for a year. He'd had school. He went to St. Peter's College from the year five through the end. And he with the mates were skateboarders and created havoc around the place on his skateboard. And of course he needed to earn some pocket money. So he'd come out to work two or three days a week just to earn some pocket money. So after 1 year I said to him, look, I said, this is not much good to you. Not much good to me. I'll tell you what I'd do. If you're interested, you can have a job full time, starting February next year. I said, you'll be under no obligation if you can find something better to do, to go. But if you stay, you'll have a car, and that'll be yours. You'll be on a salary. You won't get paid overtime. Remember, we go to work, we've got to get our work done before we go home. There's no overtime, no nothing. That's what the situation is. So I said to him, so I said, I may as well. So he stayed. So eventually I said, when my cousins, the partnership dissolved, I immediately made him 50% share in the business. So that's where he's at today. So it's entirely up to him. I'm only there for him in this day and age. So
is his are his children likely to...
No, he's not married.
He's not married.
Not yet, unfortunately.
I think that's always a problem, isn't it, with family businesses, is that inheritance, you know, knowing who the succession what's going to happen to it.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got no control over that.
No.
You know, my children know exactly what happens to me, who gets what.
Yeah.
They know exactly what's situated there.
Yeah.
So, you know, what he does, that's entirely up to him, because if he wasn't interested and wasn't there, I wouldn't be there.
No.
I don't need to be there.
Yeah. So you haven't really retired, Jim?
No.
No.
Well, I only retire when he sacks me, or he buries me, or I can't do it. So
yeah, probably the latter might be coming first if it's when...
Well, that's possible too.
Yeah. When you just can't do it anymore.
But, you know, one has to do something, you know. Some people, a lot of people retire, can't wait to retire because they've got a whole lot of things they want to do and do it, which is great. I guess I'm not quite in that situation, so
no.
I've got my other hobbies, so that's right.
Yeah, that's good. So when we met before, you mentioned that there was quite a bit of angst about the sale of the land to the government back in the, was it the 60s and 70s?
Yes. Well, at the time we knew they were going to want the property because the Oban was going to come diagonally through. My father's solicitor was Sir Keith Wilson, and he consulted with Sir Keith, and Sir Keith said, whatever you do, do not do anything. Wait till they come knocking on the door, which happened. Anyhow, my father just referred the lands buyer, the government buyer, to his solicitor, Sir Keith Wilson. So anyhow, they were in negotiation over price they were going to pay for the property. And a friend of Dad's had just sold nearby, and Dad asked him what he got for his land, and at that particular time, he just got the highest price of any land sold in the area, Well, Dad rang up the solicitor, and they were in negotiation, and the government buyers wanted to buy or pay substantially less. And Dad said, well, so-and-so just sold his land for this amount, that's what we require. And, oh, yes, that's correct. And just paid the money, which at that time was a lot of money. And it was just at the end of a real estate boom. We had booms and busts those days. It was right at the end, and after that everything went quiet. But I can remember quite clearly when growers in Campbelltown, 10-acre properties, were selling out for, I think it was £2,000 an acre, £20,000. My mother saying to my father, those lucky people, all that money. You know, we seemed a fortune. And I was old enough to recollect some of those growers retired. Within very few years, they never had enough money to live on. Some of the wise people invested in flats or something, they weren't so bad. Some of these other people had to go and get part-time jobs to live. I never ever forgot that. And you know, money devalues. If you don't invest it correctly, it devalues. So, you know, that's happened with my family too. You know, so. So that was, you know, but gradually, as you know, all of Campbelltown, Athelston, all market gardens were sold up. Because, you know, people got older and they just wanted to get out, and it's an opportunity to sell out. Some of us were too stupid and kept on going.
Oh, I don't think so. So, you know, it is huge change for this area when you think about it, just in the space of our lifetime.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I can remember as a boy riding all over the district, to Highbury, to Athelston, Norwood, all over the place. We used to ride our bikes everywhere. And it would just, you just run free. You know, it's so different. And it seemed that, like, my parents always had two cows at home for the family. Dad used to have to milk them, or one of his employees milked them when he went to market. His mum used to separate the milk for the cream. Used to take the cream to Farmers Union. You know, and it was, the household was almost self-sustaining to a degree.
So there were chickens as well?
Yes, And my mother always had help in the house twice a week, because my dad's mother lived with us until she passed away. Mum always had help in the house twice a week to clean and do the washing. So, you know, in my childhood we were fairly affluent. The fact that we had a car, we had a telephone, we had a fridge. Now, when I'm talking the late 40s. And you had neighbours that never had a car, they had the Iceman come. They never had a washing machine. We were just that much better off in that situation. But the sad part about those days, the most terrible part, was that it was the day of death duties. And I know that when my grandfather died, they were fortunate enough to have enough money to pay the death duties and retain the property. And the same thing happened when my grandmother died. They were able to pay enough money to pay the death duties to retain the property. And that's, they're the most shocking taxes to anyone can ever have. Because I know at the time they were brought in, the fact was to redistribute the wealth. The wealth gets redistributed naturally. As the families grow, get to the third generation and it goes. So they were, for anyone on the land where they have a high capital input in their property to maintain their livelihood, is the most shocking tax of all taxes.
Yes, well, it's good that it's no longer with us.
Well, we hope it will never come back, but who knows?
People in Britain still seem to have to struggle with it. But,
In the US too, in parts,
Is there anything else that you want to add to the interview at all? I've come to the end of my questions, but you might have some.
No, I can remember as a small child, what is now the Campbelltown Oval was the Glenroy Oval. the dad was on a committee, a progress committee, and a group of local growers used to meet down there to organise the trotting track and do enhance the facilities down there. They used to have a show once a year, which was magic. You know, it was all the growers used to exhibit have an exhibition of their produce. It all used to be judged. They had trotting, they had horses in action. All the local growers used to get together on the progress committee and organise it all. Mm. And it was a huge event in Campbelltown.
Yeah.
All the machinery sales people had their little displays of tractors, etc.
So it was like a mini Adelaide show.
It was.
Adelaide show,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, it was a mini Adelaide show.
Yeah.
And it used to be one Saturday a year.
What time of the year?
Look, it was in the spring as far as I can tell.
Yeah, September or something, when the weather was better.
Yeah, it was in the springtime because, you know, it wouldn't have been in the summer. I'm pretty sure it was in the spring.
And but probably at a time when you guys weren't so busy, if there was ever such a time.
No, I think everyone was busy, but, you know, it was a big event and everyone made the effort. Mm. Very much a community event.
So when did that stop?
Look, I can't tell you the date that stopped, but...
I'll have to do some research on that.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but at the time it was a very big event.
Yeah, yeah. So were there other community events like that?
No, not that I know of.
I remember reading in the newspapers, the really old newspapers, that there used to be a parade, but I think that was going back to the...
Oh, I've got photos of that.
Have you? Yes.
Yeah, so that was... that would be back in the early 1900s, That was in town, that was at the market.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
But run by people from this area.
Yeah, yeah. Boys from Payne.
Boys from Payne.
Yeah, because they're all market gardens, all the whole area right around market garden. So, you know, I can remember Dad had friends over... that Furl had big operations over there in their day. It was a real rural community.
Well, when you look around at the community and I catch the bus that goes down into town through the Furl area, I mean, the houses are all similar age.
Yes.
And the ones that are left. And, you know, so you can see that there was obviously development at certain times.
Yeah, where the Kmart is, there used to be a market garden there.
Right.
The chap used to grow cauliflowers there. And right opposite where Domino's Pizza is, and that land between there and the other road, there was people from the Adelaide Hills had that property called Richardson's. And they used to grow Swedes there every year. They used to plant them and they'd have one big spring and just to water them a bit. And they virtually grow wild.
Yeah.
They used to come and grow them there every year over the winter. So it's...
You had the land where the shops are now on Glenburn Road.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's right opposite where Sprinto Auto Electrical is in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a picture of the home there.
Yeah.
We had the land there and across the corner on Lewis Road, this triangular piece that was there opposite the Lutheran Church on Lewis Road. We had that land. Then up the road on the corner of Reed Avenue and Glen Road, there's 5 acres up there too. That's where, you know, when I was a boy, that's the property Dad had. And of course, then up the Glen Road, there was the Ryans had a peach orchard. The Elliots had a peach orchard. And up on the main road here, of course, a tram went up to Paradise.
Yes, yeah.
Up the top there was old Mick Daly, who was the mayor of Campbelltown, had a peach orchard. The Campbelltown Police Station was just up on the hill there where I got my driver's licence. And down here where the community centre is, ARC, there's market gardens in there. And down James Street, of course, we were down there, the Shepherds were down there, and we were down there, Frisbee Smiths, and Amadio's were down through this area, old Giovanni Amadio, he was a character.
Named the street after him.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
because I knew him as a
I'll add.
Yeah. So talking about fruit, because most of the people I think we're interviewing seem to have been more in the vegetable growing area. So obviously the peaches grew well around here.
Yes, they did. Mm. They did. Mr. Mardio grew very good peaches. My grandfather used to grow oranges in James Street, apparently, so I see in one of the previous books.
Actually, I think I saw in an old newspaper something about apricots as well.
Well, more than likely, yeah, they would have grown apricots, I would think. Or Dad, when he was in the Adelaide Hills, he grew most everything up there. He's grown in his lifetime, he grew nearly everything conceivable, even tobacco.
Right.
He used to, during the Depression, they made money out of growing gladioli flowers. And I can still remember as a small child, they used to grow them in the hills and bring them down and store them in the cellar in buckets of water because it was cool. They used to take them to market, and of course, all hell used to break loose after market, these buckets of water without flowers, and people would get drenched, you know, they walk past and drop a bucket of water. But, you know, that I'm going back to my very small childhood. Yeah. You just vaguely remember all those things.
They would have been heavy.
They were kerosene tins, actually.
Yes, yeah.
You know, the square, 4 gallon tins, and they always had a certain amount of water in the bottom for the flowers to sit in.
But just one sprig of beautiful
flowers.
Very heavy flowers.
Yeah, very beautiful flowers, because I used to pick them when they just started. And of course, by keeping them in the cellar, it kept them in a controlled environment, so to speak, cooler down there, because there's no coal stores or cool rooms those days. So, it was all different. And, well, of course, when you go to the market, your dad had a lot of different customers, so all sorts of characters you dealt with.
I can imagine.
Oh, larrikins too, you know. It was a hilarious area to be involved in. But
so
people had personalities, you know, and you had that rapport with a lot of different people, and which today you don't seem to have.
No. Well, yes, I guess, you know, you had it wasn't just a grower-client relationship that you had with those people either. It was much closer, probably.
Oh, yes. And, of course, you've got to remember, too, a lot of those guys come out of the Second World War. They came through the Depression. They come through shocking times. And, of course, you know, they made the most of life.
Yes.
Best they could.
No, I think we're lucky in our generation that the times we've had are much easier to live in.
Oh, yes, you know, we've had a free ride, so to speak, compared to those guys, you know. You know, I can remember my dad saying in the Depression, like he was in the Adelaide Hills, and he said it was terrible. He said, you drive your men like slaves. He said, I never ever put off men, and during the winter I always kept them employed, but he said you had to work so damned hard and hope the hell you had enough money over the end of the week to buy a packet of tobacco.
Yeah.
The men always got paid, but it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, you go to market, and he used to have a guy running around trying to sell it to help him because they had to grab every sale they could get. It was just very, very hard.
So, and a lot of men on the road getting work from all over the place.
Well, I can remember too, people would come in and see where they could chop some wood to earn some money. And then the rabbiters used to come to sell some rabbits. Yeah, so I can just vaguely remember that. And the guys would come down from the river, they'd been fishing to sell some fish. The hawkers would come around with Rawley's products and their motorbike and sidecar. And that's how they all managed to do it, get a living.
My mother didn't see her father for a couple of years during the Depression because he was on the road trying to get work. So it had an effect on everybody, didn't it?
Well, that's right. My mother's brothers went over on the West Coast rabbiting, trying to exist. You know, so they. But they made better people out of them at the end of the day.
More resilient.
Oh, tough people, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think unless you've got something else you'd like to contribute to this interview, that we can call it a day.
Yeah, that's fine.
And thank you very much, Jim, for...
Yeah, I think probably some photographs here I've got will fill in a few gaps.
We'll go through those and do that. So thank you very much, Jim, for giving up your time today.
Oh, I hope it's of some use anyhow.
I think it's been good. Thank you very much.